Hello, and welcome to Do You Even Science, a podcast where we discuss what's happening in Canadian science and policy and everything in between. We're your hosts. I'm Dr. Simon Landry, and I have with me Dr. Yeah, let's go with it. Dr. Dina Hamza. On today's episode, Green Rush or Green Goblin, the varying potencies of cannabis legalization. But first, Dina, so I've got an update with my life. Okay. Do you want to hear it?
I do.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for caring.
I'm your number one fan.
Thank you.
Your partner is probably number one.
Yeah.
I don't want to take her spot, so number two. Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that. What about my parents, though?
No, but they have to be your fan.
Yeah, so they have to. Yeah,
they don't count.
Not by choice. It's not by choice.
No, they have to.
That's true. Good point. So the big news is that I am no longer employed. Listeners,
Simon is free. If you have a position for him, he's highly skilled.
So many skills. And if RV people.
Yeah.
If you have an RV
retailer.
If you're an RV retailer and you're listening to this on community radio that I think we now air on, and you say, geez, I would like this guy to drive around the country and just talk about science.
Let's at them on Twitter. Let's find an RV company, a retailer, and say, hey, we have this genius idea. And we want to drive across Canada. And now Simon can do this because he's free. He's now a free agent.
I'm a free agent, a loose cannon. Maybe not a loose cannon. I'm a loose cannon. So position got terminated. I guess the program's going in different directions.
So they're no longer mobilizing knowledge?
They, I guess, will not be. I don't know. I'm not really sure what to make of it, honestly. But I think I don't want to dwell on it. I think the thing that's the most important, though, that I think for our listeners would be interesting is, like, what's it like being unemployed and having a PhD?
Yeah,
that's like...
I think job search is interesting because you find that you're really overqualified for positions. And the positions that you're actually qualified for, there aren't very many.
No, there aren't. And also, I signed up for EI.
Okay.
Employment insurance.
What was that process like? Just for those of us, I know that there were a couple of people actually, and you had a position, was it directly out of your PhD? Did you find a job directly out of your PhD?
I did. I was unemployed for a month, I think.
And you didn't apply for EI at that point?
No, I don't know if you can apply for EI.
I think you can. So there was someone who was in the PhD program around the time that I was completing my PhD, and I overheard a conversation that if a position didn't pan out, they would just apply for EI to tide them over. So that'd be an interesting thing to take a look at. And perhaps it might differ by university?
I don't know.
It should be something that's across Canada, though.
Well, because I feel like I'll know more once my record of employment gets added to my Service Canada profile and whatever. But I think the amount of EI you're able to have access to is based on the hours worked at the wage you're being paid at.
But as a PhD, you receive a salary.
I don't know how it was for you, but like in my taxes, I would file it under the category that's scholarships and grants.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I see what you're saying.
You know, it's not like a wage. I don't know how that works out.
It's like a stipend.
Yeah.
That would be something interesting for our listeners, because I know for some individuals, the transition from their PhD into the workforce can be challenging. So it would be good to know what are some options there. And even your process, I'd like to know more about your process. Because I think at one point or another, these are experiences that are universal. So I think it would be interesting to see how things pan out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So to kind of to walk you through the process of signing up for EI, you can do it online or at Service Canada. Mm-hmm. And when you go to Service Canada, you do it online there. So it's like, do you have a computer? Yes, just do it at home. Awesome. Yeah. So you really just go on this website, fill out some information, and then I guess they're going to mail me an access code.
Okay.
And my previous employer is supposed to send my record of employment to Service Canada.
Okay.
And then they're going to calculate what I'm entitled to. And then, yeah, I guess I'll just check that out from there.
Is there a certain duration of time that a person can be on EI?
Yes. Again, I'll have all these details, and it'll be really fun actually to update you on how this process goes. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm sorry that you lost your position. How do you feel about it though? I mean,
it's, I don't know, mixed feelings. I guess I believe, I firmly believe in the process of knowledge mobilization. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't be having this show if I didn't believe in the value.
Exactly.
And it's like, I think, I don't know, I feel like maybe, well, there was clearly a misalignment, mm-hmm. The position and the program, it didn't make sense, whatever, on an administrative level. Mm-hmm. But on a personal level, it's like, if your employer clearly doesn't believe in kind of the value of your position, then maybe it's for the best, you
know?
That's
a great challenge.
And yeah, I like the people there. Everybody's working hard and, it is what it is and you got to move on. And I've learned a lot of stuff and I got to meet you.
Yes, this is true. Yeah. You wouldn't have been at that policy conference.
Exactly. So, hey, that was worth it.
Are you a believer in the alignment of, different things in your life that puts you on a particular path?
I am. And it is, I find it frustrating because we're scientists, but at the same time, it's like, it's a full moon. Things are going to I've got these crazy superstitions.
And I completely understand that because in my culture as an Egyptian, mm-hmm. And I have very highly educated people in my family, but mm-hmm. we're very superstitious at the same time. Yeah. So it's not really based on science. But, my mom and my mom has played a really big role in helping me just, I don't want to say go with the flow, mm-hmm. but it's like roll with the punches.
Right.
So, as negative things happen, to try and take a look at it, take a step back and say, well, perhaps... Mm-hmm. I'm destined for something else. Maybe this is putting me on a different path. I don't like it right now. It's kind of challenging right now, but there may be something positive that will come out of it.
Yeah, and I think maybe this just clicked now, but maybe one of the things that I've learned over kind of the grad school experience is how to deal with setbacks.
Of course.
And it's like, of course. This is, it happens all the time.
I mean, even research itself, right? It's like failure after failure, but is it really mm-hmm. failure? It's like you're learning along the way.
Exactly. And it's like, what can you learn from this? What appreciate what you got from it and don't dwell on it and just kind of move on, basically.
I agree.
And So I filed for EI, which is like a super easy process. The people there were very friendly. Good. Shout out to the Service Canada office. I don't know where it was, Spadina and something in Toronto. They were very kind. And then after that, so it turns out that the federal government is in charge of employment insurance.
Okay.
So they're the ones that when you're unemployed, they send you money to help you stay on your feet.
Right.
Also, as an aside, I love that Canada has a strong social support system.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I hope I never, when I'm a millionaire, when I'm older, I hope I never become a millionaire who's cut my taxes. Why do the poor need those things?
Never want to be one of those people.
No. When I'm a millionaire. And so that's really nice. It's like really, it helps through the that transition.
I agree.
It's really,
you have that kind of that something to fall back on.
Mm-hmm. And so that's the federal government, and the provincial government is in charge of training and kind of like getting you a job.
So will you have access to kind of like professional development?
Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. So I went to the, so that in Ontario is, it's really interesting the way it's organized. So Service Ontario, provides resources to get a job, kind of like CV, supervision and interview prep and stuff like that.
And they can, well, yeah, so they can help you develop your cover letter, your CV.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. But the way that it's structured is you don't go to a Service Ontario office. There are like private, semi-private offices around the city.
Okay.
That you go to. So I went to one that's run by Humber College.
Okay. I think they have something similar. It's also at the University of Alberta. Well, they'll provide some support services.
Yes. And they get money from the provincial government.
Okay. Interesting.
And yeah. And when you go, you sign up, you would register like a, I want to say a caseworker, but that's not what they are. Like the employment specialist.
Okay.
Would kind of get your profile as the center, like as part of the center's clients.
Okay.
And so I think they receive funding based on how many clients they get.
Okay.
And
so like, it's, so they promote it really well so that they can bring
exactly.
in more clients. But
exactly.
So I understand that from the CV, cover letter, prep for the interview, but do they offer any other professional development? Like, for example, if you want to move into becoming an entrepreneur, mm-hmm, do they have mm-hmm. workshops and things like that? Or
they do. I went there yesterday, so I'm still like navigating
that
system.
Still new.
Yeah, it's still very fresh. They do have a lot of programs. I think though that a lot of the programs are more geared towards if you're in a job that no longer exists, for example.
Okay.
And you want to train for a second career, they can like provide funding and point you in the right direction.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. So yeah, it's neat. It's really interesting to see what's out there, and I'm excited to.
It's a new experience.
Yeah, exactly. I'm excited to update our listeners, update you about what it's like.
Yeah, I think this is important. We can learn from your experiences, be better prepared.
Exactly. Just to be a loose cannon, see what that's like.
I like this. I envy your situation.
All right, so that's what's going on. Let's do a very interesting seg to cannabis legalization.
Yeah, Green Rush or Green Goblin.
Oh, what's that about, Dina?
Well, I think that you and I, perhaps, Simon, would be on opposing sides. Is this what you
you
interpret in terms of the legalization
Yeah.
I don't know if I want to say marijuana or cannabis. I mean, most people are saying in the public, it's like the legalization of marijuana. We tend to say cannabis.
Yeah, isn't marijuana racist?
Oh, I haven't heard that.
Yeah, because it's like, I think marijuana was the term that Mexicans would call it back in the day, because it's like the J is pronounced H, so it's like Spanish. And by calling it marijuana, you're using like the Spanish word, and they were like, watch out for marijuana, it'll make you go crazy.
And so it had like a race component to it.
Yeah. And so calling it cannabis, I guess, is like the English word for the plant or whatever.
The true term or the appropriate term. So we will stick with cannabis. I didn't realize that it had this, you know, this racial undertone to it.
Yeah. Because I guess the whole process of getting it, making it illegal in the, when was it, like 40s or 50s, was very racially charged.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was like to kind of the Mexicans brought it in, and they were like, look at those dirty foreigners, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Which we could also say that now. It's just,
Yeah.
Strange.
That's interesting. I wonder how many of our listeners knew that the term marijuana had this aspect of racism to it.
Yeah.
It was a new point for me. So, Simon, do you know what the difference is between decriminalizing a substance and legalizing it?
I don't, but I think we didn't touch on what I think your
Are we going to go back? Position
on it. Okay, so let's go back.
Okay, so first let me say what decriminalizing and legalizing is, and then you can say whether what side of the fence you think I sit on.
Perfect.
Does that work?
Works great.
Okay, so decriminalizing a substance means that it's a person would have like a civil fine rather than a criminal charge if they're found in possession of the substance. But that's not if it's an amount that could be trafficked. Mm. So it has to be like an amount that's, you know, for personal use.
So what are other examples of what a civil charge, you said?
A civil charge. So you could have something like perhaps if somebody was using the substance in their vehicle, they're pulled over. It's like alcohol.
Okay, are there other, is it kind of like a parking ticket? Is it like
Something like, it's a fine. So it would be something like, I don't know, let's say $200 fine because you were found in possession of a substance for personal use because the manufacture and sale of this substance remains illegal.
Right.
That's under decriminalization. So essentially it's on the individual level that if you are caught with a small amount for personal use, you will no longer receive jail time or have a criminal charge on your record. You would just receive a fine.
So would that prevent you from like getting a job or something?
Yeah, something along those lines. Yeah, so you wouldn't have it on your record.
Oh, okay. So if it's if something is decriminalized and you get caught with it,
you just pay a fine.
Oh, and that's
it. But it's not on your record, and the substance, because it continues to be manufactured and sold in an illegal capacity, it's not regulated by the state.
Okay.
So it's not government regulated, it's unregulated.
Okay.
So you're decriminalizing, but you're not taking out, for example, you know, how cannabis can be laced with fentanyl.
Can it? Is that a thing?
Apparently. Fact check.
We looked it up, and here was what former Health Minister Jane Philpott had to say about fentanyl in cannabis. And this is from November 2017.
There have, in fact, been rumors of the possibility of cannabis that has been laced with fentanyl. In fact, there is zero evidence. Very important that everyone understands that there, and we have confirmed this with chiefs of police, law enforcement officials across the country, there is zero documented evidence that ever in this country has cannabis been found laced with fentanyl. So it's very important that we make sure that that message is clear.
So that's our fact check. So let's say it's an unpure substance. Let's put it that way. It's a substance that... And it's not even like laced, you know, with fentanyl, it's like the amount that can be fatal for an individual is smaller than a grain of salt.
Yeah. Like that. So there was like, you know, in high school, it was like, oh, people are spraying Windex on cannabis and then people go nuts or like, it's like, it was a thing that people Windex? Said. I don't know. I heard that. Maybe it's an East Coast thing. Listeners,
West Coast. Things are different. That's true. Yeah. That's true.
If you're listening to this and you've heard about apparently Windex-laced cannabis.
I think we need to have a poll because I've never heard of that. And why would that be a good idea?
I don't know. But that's kind of the same thing. Like, I feel like the effort that you would need if you have a bunch of cannabis.
Yeah.
The like Venn diagram of somebody who deals cannabis and who also deals fentanyl, I feel is very, very small. And then I'd be surprised that they'd be like, oh yeah, this is what I'm going to do. You know, like who are these people? It just seems so silly.
But it's about keeping the demand for your supply. So if you're creating something that's slightly different...
It would be.
It depends on who you're targeting, right?
If like, I don't know, I think it's just so silly, and like I can't imagine somebody buying cannabis, smoking it, getting an opiate, like a strong opiate rush and going, this is what I was looking for. And then they're like an opiate withdrawal.
Maybe they don't know, but maybe they don't know what's in it. They're just like, I felt really awesome. This substance from this particular dealer made me forget a lot of my challenges or a lot of the problems that I'm facing.
You certainly would forget a whole lot.
So wouldn't you? But then that keeps you craving that combination. So you would go back to that same dealer.
Maybe. And also I feel like opiates would... I don't know about their mechanisms.
Like more of an addictive potential. Yes.
But can
which is controversial
burn?
Because some people are saying that, cannabis, we have cannabis use disorder.
Yeah.
Right? So.
All right. Well, at this point, we need to go back to the topic.
So that neither was decriminalization. One of us. No. We're not dealers for a reason.
Yeah, exactly.
For this is one of them.
If ever we're like caught in like some sort of kerfuffle and they're like, oh, Dina and Simon were dealing drugs, they'll be like, here's the evidence that clearly we have no idea.
We're not into this.
It is impossible.
I specialize in the prevention and early intervention in substance use disorders. I mean, that would be a really good cover.
And I'm on EI. So
yeah, but no,
second.
No, I... Breaking Bad too.
We're the dream team.
We'll be like Making Good instead of Breaking Bad. It'll be like Making Good.
We'll funnel the profits to like policy change.
Yeah. Drug policy. So that's decriminalization. Legalization is that you're taking out any laws associated with banning the possession for personal use.
Mm-hmm.
The judicial system, so it kind of, you're in the judicial system, if you're caught with a small amount, it doesn't really go to that system. So again, you're not going to receive a criminal sanction based on what you have for personal use. But government now plays a role in regulating the use and sales.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? So it's taking the industry from the hand of... Often, I'm doing air quotes here, the hand of criminals, but a select few. And, the point is that you would reduce criminal activity associated with the manufacture and sale of the substance. And you would regulate what is out there so it would be safer for consumers. So this idea, if let's say there's cannabis that's laced with fentanyl, you wouldn't have that in this legalized system.
Right. Yeah.
So what side do you think I'm on here, Simon?
All right. I'm going to walk you through my reasoning because So
justify it.
Exactly. Exactly. So if I'm wrong, then we can be like, oh, it wasn't a sweeping statement. I just had one tiny thing that was off. So I think that. So you don't drink alcohol. Right?
Yeah.
So, and you work in public health. So you've seen
In public health, but all of my work has been in either psychiatry, family medicine, but focused on preventing
substance misuse.
Yeah, preventing substance misuse, beginning with youth and early intervention if someone is at risk of developing a substance use disorder and concurrent mental health issues.
So, yeah, so I feel like you would, I suspect that you would not be super on board because by legalizing it, it kind of makes it easier to access and sort of like the buck a beer thing.
Yes.
Like by making it legal, it's kind of like lowering the barrier to entry. And it'll seem more acceptable, I guess. And then there could be an increased chance of misuse.
So let me ask you this before I tear apart your justification.
Oh, no.
What are your thoughts on harm reduction? And what's your perception of my take on harm reduction? So that means safe injection sites, controlled drinking.
Mm-hmm.
What are your, or like the vending machines that will have, you know, opioids like heroin or those kinds of things. There's like, in the works, there's this idea of having vending machines that would release pure substances rather than substances that are laced with, it's part of the harm reduction mandate.
Oh, it sounds, by calling it a vending machine, it sounds like they're just going to be in every corner store.
No.
But I suspect like that's not the case. Yeah.
Yeah. It'd be like in a hospital.
Yeah. I think that you would be very progressive on those issues because you kind of understand the
thumbs up, Simon.
Am I just disproving myself?
Yes. Did you see how that worked?
No.
So funny story.
Mm-hmm.
I was an invited speaker at a hospital event, and it was specific to substance misuse, and we had to present as researchers on our work, and I was asked to be on a panel of experts about the legalization of cannabis and what my perspective from my role as an expert and how I see the outcome.
Right.
And I went into this talk. There were other people like from public health, and there was a psychiatrist. And some people were saying, well, we don't really see any harms. If we look at Colorado, we don't really see any negative outcome from the legalization of cannabis. And others were saying, well, but if we're having a harm reduction approach, what do we do in a hospital unit? Are we where we have, you know, things like controlled alcohol use, which actually comes in a prescription bottle, looks like a medicine bottle.
What
it's controlled drinking. So somebody who has an alcohol use disorder and is unable to abstain from using the substance. And we don't want them to cold turkey stop because there's a high risk of mortality.
Really?
In doing that. Yeah. A lot of people aren't aware that, you know, just stopping alcohol use for somebody who has an alcohol use disorder is life threatening.
Is it use or disuse or misuse? Because you've used both. So is it substance use?
It's misuse. Misuse, yeah. Okay. So it's the misuse of the substance. So whether it's binge drinking or it's where it's the use of the substance is now negatively affecting your function and your responsibilities.
Right. Okay.
So, the controlled drinking for an individual who's in a patient in the hospital, they receive it in a medicine bottle, and it's a certain amount that will just keep them functional.
That's so funny. Who, like,
this is at Royal Alex Hospital. They have the controlled drinking program. There's a lot of evidence of its effectiveness, and that as a harm reduction approach, some individuals can, make it to a point where the amount that they need to function decreases over time. So you're actually helping an individual move away from having to abstain from a substance. So we're moving away from the abstinence model to understanding that people gradually reduce their substance misuse to a
that
smaller
amount. That seems super reasonable.
Doesn't it? A lot of people are against it, though. There are groups that are against safe injection sites, and that's reducing harms related to, you know, using dirty needles or So that's a safe injection. So we're reducing risk of hepatitis, risk of, you know, HIV.
Yeah.
And so on. But yeah, I was on this panel, and so I went into this like big spiel of we haven't yet managed alcohol misuse, and you know, now we have, you know, the chance of cannabis, and here we have alcohol as an example of illegal substances, and the number of adolescents that are, you know, engaging in risky alcohol use. And I forgot to preface in this, like, to this audience, like the looks on these people's faces was like, you know, like I was just like, get her out of the room. Yeah. We don't want her here. And I forgot to prep it.
She's Egyptian. Of course she would.
Yeah, just like, just bring my culture into it. Bring my religion into it. You know, except like hashish is like a major problem in Egypt, but never mind. Yeah, I forgot to preface by saying I'm not against the legalization of cannabis, but we need to have the, you know, programs available for individuals. And that's where I would then lead into, we haven't yet managed alcohol misuse because it's such a, you know, prevalent thing with youth populations.
Yeah.
And we don't have great prevention and early intervention programming that we... While we legalize cannabis, we also have to set up appropriate programming in the event somebody misuses cannabis. And, you know, often I get the public health group that say, no, no, there's no evidence of people, you know, misusing. It's, you know, the problems that already exist aren't going to increase. Okay, but we still have individuals, you know, experiencing cannabis use disorder.
Yeah.
We have to have programs available.
Here's a question that I never thought of until right now. Do you think that if alcohol and cannabis were reversed, like if cannabis was legal and alcohol prohibition was still on,
right,
would we, like, because the research kind of shows that cannabis is like less ultimately harmful.
I think than we just alcohol, don't have as much information. So alcohol and tobacco, we didn't know of all the harms until I think one public health, this was through Mass General, Massachusetts. Did I pronounce that right? Massachusetts.
I think so.
General Hospital. There's a lot of people through public health there that have said, well, it took us 10 years after legalizing these substances that it's like, whoa, wait, we actually have a lot of problems, a lot of health problems and social problems as a result of the legalization.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's too early to tell. I mean, the evidence suggests with cannabis that there's some impact on, you know, our cognition and memory. Yeah. And for those who want, you know, the more technical, it's the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex that are affected. Mm-hmm. In some studies, it shows that if somebody stops using cannabis within 6 months, their memory is back to normal. Other studies, it seems to be more long term, and it's and it depends on when you use.
Right.
You're using during, you know, adolescent years with the developing brain.
Yeah.
It's supposed to have a more negative impact.
I read this excellent, just like, this is the best way I've ever read to explain adolescent, like why you shouldn't smoke as a young person.
Smoke and cannabis or smoke
cannabis? Tobacco? Yeah, okay. Cannabis. And I guess also tobacco, but this is more cannabis. And the way that this, I think it was a dad or a parent, could have been a mom, was explaining it to their child is like, if you look at a tree and you want to swing on it, do you set up the swing when the tree is young? It's like, no, you can still swing, but you need to wait for the tree to have grown and to be able to support the swing so that you can enjoy it.
Yes.
Otherwise it's going to break and you'll just never be able to have fun on it.
Right.
And so it's like an interesting, I think a really interesting visual to demonstrate.
I think that's interesting. Yeah. I haven't heard of that as an approach, but like to talk to an adolescent about it, but.
Or even a small child, like a 6-year-old, because it's going to be legal everywhere.
Yes.
In Canada. And so that's a really easy visual, I think, for them to get. They'd be like, oh yeah.
Yes. So it's pretty controversial right now in terms of we just don't have enough research. We don't have enough long-term research. That will come with time. But I think that there have to be the supports available for opportunistic screening so you can identify people early if they're at risk of developing a use disorder. We can catch them early and then have the appropriate access to programs so they're timely and they fit the needs of the individual. I'm not against the legalization of cannabis. Cool. But you know what's interesting?
What?
A recent article about the center of the universe.
Is it Toronto? Is it about Toronto?
Is.
Yes. Tell me more.
Toronto's like in, well, Ontario in general, in the news. So we heard about the backtracking about the sexual education.
That we caused? That I think that
we totally caused major waves because we're like, who's accountable? And they're like, whoa,
I don't want to be accountable.
So this is from the medical officer of health, Dr. Mm-hmm. Davila. Who wants to or is advocating for the decriminalization of all drugs. So following the model in Portugal, and it's that we will and Portugal decriminalized all substances in 2001.
Oh, so
they've,
how's that working out?
They've been on this model apparently really well, like in terms of the overdose rates. Mm-hmm. Apparently they have 3 drug-related overdoses per 1 million people. Versus in the European Union, 17.3% per 1 million people.
Per million.
So apparently their system is working. I think there are a lot, like context is important. We can't just take a model and just drop it down. There's context factors that are at play. Yeah. I'm not sure what they are. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so this medical officer of health is saying we need to decriminalize all drugs, move this from a criminal issue to one that's a public health issue. And it's the push for the federal government to make this change.
It's the way to do it. Like,
it makes sense when you really understand substance misuse.
It's so easy to, when you're walking down the street and you see somebody who has like a substance misuse issue, to point at them and be like, oh, you're not working hard enough, or like,
no, it's like, hey,
a job,
you've got an illness, go to jail. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
That's essentially what it is.
Yeah. And it's not like, oh, maybe there are these complex societal issues that like have led you to want to escape reality because like you've had a super tough life.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things too that I forgot to mention here, Simon, is that in shifting it from a criminal issue, like when we decriminalize, is that we're saying, okay, it's no longer a criminal act to be in the possession of a substance for personal use.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the policy, the drug policy, is supposed to also offer treatment.
Oh.
That's within the mandate. Like, that's the ideal scenario. But I'm just wondering, like, what does that look like? So let's say I'm pulled over for whatever reason. I have a broken taillight.
Yes.
And they find that I'm in possession of cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe like cannabis now? Isn't. No, prior to the legalization.
Okay.
I'm in possession of cannabis and this officer is not going to treat this as a criminal issue. So I will be fined. So it's like a civil issue. I'll receive a fine, but I won't have anything on my criminal record. Does that officer then say, here are a list of programs that you can access? Right. And then what does that look like? Because we know in our last episode, we talked about the continuity of care. So how you go from one professional to the next without having disjointed services. So, and we know it's not enough to say, here's a list of places to go. So what does that look like?
And I guess it's kind of like if you, I don't know, walk around and have a beer, an open container, and a cop was to give you a fine, I wouldn't want that cop to be like, oh, also, by the way, here's like the phone number for the Center of Mental Health and Addiction.
But here's what can happen though, Simon. So for example, let's say you are in public and you're intoxicated.
Mm-hmm.
And the police come, rather than taking you to a jail cell, they would actually take you to perhaps a detox center or a shelter.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So at least they're, I guess, making the first connection.
Right. Okay.
But I guess you would have to be under the influence of the substance for that to happen.
But yeah, or maybe you're just like, I don't know, coming back from a party and I don't know, it's like, yeah, I guess you need to make those services accessible,
but we and also have figure to have out who's your audience. People. So are we actually training? So that's
you're right.
you know, you're so right. So are we actually training police officers? That's why now in the news, I think it was a couple of months ago, they would have somebody who specializes in behavioral health that would ride with a police officer.
Oh.
So they would be able to identify someone with, you know, a mental illness or somebody with a substance use disorder.
You know what? I bet this would be a really interesting AI program or project.
Wouldn't it? Yes.
Yeah. Where you could have, because I bet there are so many voice markers, you know, like, because there's a team here who's working on voice markers for, I think, Alzheimer's or like cognitive decline. And I feel like you can probably train something so it'd be like, oh, this person likely is in this category. You should probably
somebody's having a psychotic episode or something along those lines.
Based on voice and the way they're behaving.
Yes. That'd be interesting. Hmm. That'd be an interesting project. But so this is this idea of, you know, decriminalizing, legalization. Mm-hmm. The idea is that there are more harms associated with individuals trying to seek substances, and they will it will be illegal means of the production, obtaining, and the consumption of the substance. So knowing the idea of or the health issues related to having a substance use disorder, harm reduction seems, and the decriminalization and legalization seems to be the ideal path.
Where do you think toxic masculinity fits in there? Like the idea that
can you define that for me?
So, because I suspect that a large part of our inability to accept that there are complex issues associated with substance misuse is not wanting to face that people have complicated emotions, and for cops not being trained in empathy. And kind of like, there's a huge societal kind of weight of like, shoot the bad guys and all that, and not like having conversations.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's like what you're hitting on, Simon, is like it's a paradigm shift, right? It's this transformation of how our criminal justice system interacts with our most vulnerable.
In like a very like patriarchal way.
Yes.
Like in a dad that's disappointed in your behavior and who's like, you failed the whatever.
Or this idea is like, I'm going to beat it out of you.
Exactly.
You know, if I'm really tough on you, then you'll just stop. And that's not the way a substance use disorder works.
Yeah.
So I think it would go back to, and I think that's where it may appear like your original perception is that, whoa, like Dina would not be aligned with decriminalizing or legalizing substances. It's not that. I'm on board, but that is one piece of a puzzle that by just changing that one piece, we're not changing enough. So I think for this piece of decriminalization, legalization to work, we actually need all these other pieces to fall in place. And in recent articles, you know, going back to Portugal and, you know, they only have 3 drug-related overdoses per 1 million people.
Yeah.
There have been quite a few experts in the area in recent articles, in the Globe and Mail.
The old Globe and Mail.
Talking about why Canada would not follow Portugal's model. And from what I've gathered from those articles is that it's politically based, that there are so many people that are invested in the idea of no, we don't want to legalize or decriminalize substances, that it's this platform. So there's this political agenda that perhaps in the future would become an election platform for someone.
Yeah, because you'd think, I guess when you mentioned the Portugal model, I'm sorry, your listeners, I'm recording at home. I can hear pigeons outside as well as sirens.
Bad boys. I heard a siren. What you gonna do? They're coming for Simon.
They're coming for, exactly. They heard about our schemes.
Yeah, your EI, like you just put that out into the public space. EI, my cover as this expert in substance misuse.
Exactly. Yeah, so like when you hear about Portugal, you kind of think like, here's a model that works. Let's just kind of copy paste it over in Canada and then we'll be done and save a bunch of lives. But I guess that's not the way it works.
I think we actually need to have research done in that area. What is the context? So it's that piece of taking it from the individual level to the implementation science level. So what systems, enablers, barriers allowed this model to work? And what are the government features? What are the features of the society, of the community?
Yeah.
Does it work for everyone?
Yeah.
What is their reporting? You know how they had said in, I don't know if you've come across this in the past, Simon, but certain countries want certain stats to be collected and released to the public.
Okay.
So we don't actually see the real stats.
Right.
So is this the same framework? These are things, these are the research questions that I think need to be answered for us to then say, okay, Portugal's doing this. Now we can adapt based on these features. We can try and adapt it to the Canadian context.
Right. And I hope they'll be really transparent with the data they collect on that.
Well, would they allow people to come in and do research? I don't know.
Well, I don't know, but more like they will be collecting, there will be data being collected, and it would be great if they use that opportunity as a way to have that open government, that open data policy, and to be like, hey, here's what we've got. And then Canadian companies and the public could take a look and be like, oh, geez, here we can also draw our own conclusions from this data.
So here's another piece, Simon. Maybe it's not even government influence, but collecting information on substance misuse requires at some point, I mean, we have the bioverification of, let's say, the blood, urine, hair tests. That's our completely objective, positivist paradigm of collecting data. And we've got stats on that. Let's say somebody who comes through the ER, how many alcohol-related injuries? Blood test, right? We've got that. We've collected it. But at some point, let's say Stats Canada's like, I'm going to survey individuals 11 to 25 about their use of substances. That relies on self-report.
Oh,
so
that's
the stats we have. So even the conversation of other places who have legalized cannabis haven't had an increase in the number of people who are using. What are those stats based on? Is it based on self-report?
Yeah. And I guess that goes into something that we often talk about, like the understanding science, the way science is conducted is so helpful for people to get what the
And it's educating the community on that.
With maybe an RV that just cruises around.
I'm going to find a retailer.
So, so Dina, before we're kind of running out of time, but I wanted to just go back to the decriminalization of all drugs in Toronto. And so the board chair is Councillor Joe Mehevic.
Okay.
And This is a surprise. I told you I had a surprise for you.
Oh, what is it, Simon?
He's my counselor.
What?
Yeah. So I called him.
No!
I did. I called his office. You sent me a few articles.
Yes.
And I was reading them. And then I noticed his name. And I was like, geez, he's my counselor. And so I called his office. And I was like, hey, I'm with a community radio / podcast. And I mean, we're a pretty huge deal. We've already caused a few changes in the province. Would you like to sort of not be on the show, but do you have anything to contribute on the challenges?
Yeah, like what's your statement? What's your position statement on this? Yeah.
On policy informed or evidence informed foreign policy on this. And the person I spoke with thought that he would be into it.
Oh.
And yeah. And so, we might have a little segment.
I think you should interview him. I think you should go in person, record the conversation with his permission.
Yeah, of course.
And that would be interesting to see the position on that.
Yeah, so we might have a little special segment next
was
episode.
Was his position listed in this article?
Was
he
not,
one of the people that had said that decriminalization at this point in Canada is not likely?
I don't know. He said the only way that federal laws are going to change is if we provoke that national conversation.
Okay.
And the person I spoke with in his office made it clear that this is very much a grassroots effort.
Okay.
And the idea, I think what they're going for is kind of, because Toronto is the largest city in Canada,
yes.
they want
the universe.
The center of the universe. You may have heard about it. Drake's from here. do you know Drake? He's from Toronto. And yeah, so their idea is to kind of get it started here and then send this policy document to the 10 largest cities and kind of just keep this ball rolling and make sure that it is from the community that would then influence federal policy, which is a super interesting process that I mean, we might be involved in and help further the agenda of.
Good for you, Simon. So there's another interesting component here.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes into the title, where it's the varying potencies of cannabis legalization.
Ooh.
So in part of my research on the policies and laws associated with the legalization of cannabis in Canada, it turns out that there's quite a bit of variability. One of the things that seems to be, like, as the general, the general idea that I've gathered from the documents is that on the West Coast, you can be 18 or over to use cannabis. On the East Coast, you need to be 19 or older.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. The number of personal plants that you can grow, there seems to be a general consensus of 4 plants maximum.
With Quebec being 0.
Oh, is it Quebec 0?
Which I find interesting.
Oh. Mm-hmm. No personal plants.
Nope. Not according to the document you had sent me from
CDC. Okay, and we will post those documents. I think that document was from April.
Okay, yeah, it may have changed.
It may have changed. And then what differs is where you can purchase. So that there's places that have more of the private companies that you can purchase your cannabis from. Some other provinces have a combination of government run and privately owned.
Yeah.
But what differs, which I thought was interesting being from Edmonton,
is
public consumption. And apparently Edmonton has the most lax laws associated with consuming cannabis in public.
Good old Stoner Edmonton, they call it.
No, but, you know, Simon, there was an article saying that, you know, Edmonton's going to be like the number one tourist spot. That's which, so as funny. An aside, there was this other article which named the top two cities in Canada that people want to visit.
Right.
One was Toronto. Two was
other?
Edmonton.
So funny.
I love Edmonton, born and raised. But,
well, not born and raised. What are you talking about? Two episodes ago, you were saying you were born in Egypt, and that's how you didn't know The Bachelor.
What? No, I was raised by immigrants.
Oh,
that's different than being born in Egypt.
I thought you came here when you were young or something.
Wow, Simon, totally judgmental. Yeah, what? Just because I don't know The Bachelor, I was born in a foreign country? Okay, let's just, I need to put this out there, okay? And I know we're likely going to lose a lot of fans. When I was in Hamilton a week ago, 2 weeks ago, I had it on a channel, don't know what channel it was, just in the background, and then The Bachelorette came on. I do not know. It's a train wreck. Like,
it's a huge train wreck.
It's like, I don't want to watch this because I feel like knowledge is seeping out of my brain, like important knowledge, and it's being filled with all this useless garbage. But at the same time, I couldn't look away.
You loved it.
I just had so many questions. Like who's going to get the rose? Who's going to get the rose? Just tell me.
That's why you got to watch next week.
No, I just can't do it. So, yeah. Right. So back to this, you know, the public consumption. Mm-hmm. I mean, Edmonton, you know, so the way it works is that if you consume in public, the fines would be similar to being fined for alcohol use in public.
Okay.
But apparently Edmonton doesn't have those laws. They're much more lax than any other province, and I wonder why. And it's not just provincially. When you look at Edmonton versus Calgary, Calgary has much stricter laws than Edmonton. And then what does that mean for the city overall? In this one article, they're saying, well, now you're going to get all the individuals that want to consume cannabis in public that are going to flock over to Edmonton. I don't know if that's true, but...
I don't know. Maybe. I feel like the... With smoking, smoking is, like, much more obnoxious than sitting down and drinking. And it'll probably...
But there are laws, right? So they'll follow like the tobacco laws of like how much distance you can be away from an entrance. You can't smoke cannabis in a restaurant or a bar. Like so there will be those kinds of laws. But recently Portugal allowed for, I think it was 2017, that they allowed for public consumption of cannabis. So you could just like walk down the street and like smoke cannabis.
Huh. I don't know. I'm very liberal when it comes to stuff like that. Also, I feel like there's a point where like
you're kind of worried about your lungs.
Well, the lungs thing, like it's your personal choice. I'm just thinking like, you know, sometimes you're walking behind someone and they're vaping and it just smells like popcorn or something. And you're like, ugh, I'm stuck behind. Yeah. I don't know. It'll be like that everywhere for the smell of cannabis.
Yes. Yeah.
It's just like, it can be a hassle.
Yes. Well, it's the personal choice to use. I think part of my concern would be like the secondhand smoke component and the impact. And there is evidence, there's quite a bit of evidence of the impact of families who use cannabis in the house and the impact on their children, on the respiratory system.
Interesting.
So there's, you know.
All right. Well, this has been really, really interesting, Dina. And I suspect that we will revisit the topic after October. What is it? 17th?
17th, October, I believe. Yes.
17th. Yeah. So it's definitely, this conversation is definitely not done. Just the beginning, exactly. What are your thoughts on treating drug use as a public health issue rather than a criminal one? What are your views on a policy to decriminalize all the drugs in Canada or just in Toronto? For cannabis legalization, center of the universe, good old Toronto. For cannabis legalization, should all provinces follow one set of guidelines? Should they set their own, or should it be up to the municipalities? If you have opinions, tweet us at @DYES_podcast. Let us know what you think. And on our next episode, I'm really excited for this one, Dina. Because me too. What's special about next episode?
Episode number 10. It's our 10. First anniversary. It's our DYES anniversary.
It is 10 episodes. Who thought we would get this far? I think we both did.
Especially with all those mic challenges, those technical difficulties that I blamed on the technical stuff. But it was human error.
Totally human error. But hey, that ties in perfectly with the theme of the episode is win some, lose some. And so next week, to celebrate our success.
Win some, lose a lot?
Win some, lose a lot. Yeah, as long as you win a bit, I guess. We're going to be honest and share some of the failures we experienced and survived as scientists.
I'm ready for this. I've got a bucket full.
Big old bucket of failures.
All right, Simon.
All right, this has been a lot of fun. So see you next time, Dina.
You bet. Take care.